Now I realize that that mini medley of those hits may be longer than some interviews that we've done, but that's what happens when you've sold more than 100 million records. You are the most successful rock and roll instrumentalist of all time, and your name is Dwayne Eddy. Hey, Dwayne.
Hey, how are you?
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
Good. It's been forever since we talked.
I know. You were going to stop by, and I guess you got sidetracked.
Yes, we did. We were heading down south, but we think of you all the time. This has been a good year for you.
Yeah, it's been nice.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun.
You were out in California for the 50th anniversary of the Hollywood Bowl, right?
Well, for the 50th anniversary of rock and roll.
Rock and roll of the Hollywood Bowl, yes.
And I happened to be the first artist that played rock and roll on that stage, so...
And that was
let me come back and do it again.
That was originally with one of the old old Dick Clark Caravan of Stars shows.
No, he didn't. No, it was just a separate show that he had at the time.
And we have seen. In fact, we're going to share with the kids a little later a little bit of the audio from when you're on stage and you've got this big Hollywood Bowl orchestra behind you and you're jamming with this other guy named B.B. King.
Yeah, B.B. King and James Galway, and playing flute, and I had the original sax player, Gil Bernal, playing sax on that, so the original sax player on Rebel Rouser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was that one of those nights when you looked around and you said to yourself, you know, I've had a kind of a cool life?
Yeah, except that it was very hot there. Nothing cool about it.
Yeah.
No, it was very warm that night, but we had a great time, and Liza Minnelli was there dancing around while we were playing the finale, and B.B. was smiling at me and blazing away there with his Lucille, and it was just a great time.
Yeah.
And then the fireworks went off after the orchestra joined in with us, and... It was just great.
Well, this is, as Johnny said, this has been an incredible year for you, and more on the horizon. We keep getting emails and calls from people who want to know what's going on with your new album, but I want to segue right to something that we found out about earlier this week, and we were talking about it on the air. You are already a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
But now you are going into the Musicians Hall of Fame. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. That's a special honor to me because it's a Hall of Fame of musicians, the sidemen, for the most part. I mean, there's some producers and groups that are going to be in as well, but... an artist like myself, but it's mostly has to do with musicians, and the producers that are going in are great musicians as well, and like Billy Sherrill, who's going in with me, and
by the way, hi, Deed.
Yeah. By the way, hi, Deed.
That would be Deed Eddy, the Peanut Gallery.
Booker T and the MGs are going in.
Oh, neat, yeah.
And the Crickets.
So
that'll be fun.
And this is going to be in October, on October 28th, down in Nashville at the, Schermerhorn Symphony Center?
Close enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Schermerhorn, I'm not sure exactly, but I'll have to learn that before I get down there. But it's a beautiful new hall. The acoustics are great and everything, so it should be fun. But like I said, it's a big honor for me because the sidemen were always my heroes, you know.
Well, and I was kind of wondering about this, as I said earlier tonight, I would think that this would be at least as important, if not more important to you, as your induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because this is the musicians. These are the guys who make the music. This is the bottom line, and this is really kind of cool.
Yeah, and I've been fortunate enough to have some of the best ones in my band. And like last year, they put the Wrecking Crew in and have three or four of those guys started with me. And like Jim Horn and Larry Nechtel and Steve Douglas and so forth. And they all became top session guys and part of the Wrecking Crew, as they called themselves. Mm-hmm. And I've also recorded with them all through the 60s and even worked on the road with people like Don Randy and Hal Blaine and others of the Wrecking Crew. And so it's been great.
Well, now, are you going to be able to put together a band for this the concert at the Schermerhorn Symphony Center on October 28th?
Yeah, they're putting a group together. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's going to be yet. So, I mean, there's no lack of musicians here.
Yeah.
I heard something about David Hungate on bass and John Hobbs on piano.
Wow, nice.
So, I don't know who.
I was a little surprised that it was just, I don't know. I thought you would have been the first person to be put into the Hall of Fame, but that's just me.
Isn't that funny? I thought I never would be because they kind of look at me like I'm an artist more than a musician. But of course, I'm an artist musician, so I got both areas covered, I guess.
That's interesting. Yeah, and you mentioned Rebel Rouser, and you know, that was your first. Top 10 that goes back to 50 years. So yeah.
50 years. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing because I know you have to do as we do and you just say, oh, it can't be, because you remember the first time. We remember the first time we heard it. You probably clearly recall, you know, the first time you realized it was going to be a hit.
Yeah, I remember that year very clearly because we recorded it in March, and about this time of the year, it was just coming out of the top 10, and Ramrod was going up the charts in September of 58, I think.
In fact, I'd like us to talk a little bit about that, because nowadays, you know, an artist will put out a record, and then you say, well, you know, when they had their last record 3 years ago, because they've supposedly been working for those 3 years, and if people look at Duane Eddy's discography, you see in 58, you had, well, you had at least four that were huge, and then the next year it was six, and then they just kept on coming. And we'll talk a little bit about how the process was different than it is today, and we're talking with Duane Eddy, and we hope you guys will stick with us.
News Talk 720 WGN with Steve King and Johnny Putman. This man does more with the E string. he can get more soul out of a low note on the E string than anybody on the planet. We're fortunate enough to be talking with our friend, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, now going into the Musicians Hall of Fame, Duane Eddy.
And Duane, we were talking about 50 years ago when you had four songs that really made you a household name back in 58, and then the next year it was like five or six more. And nowadays it seems like somebody comes out with a record or an album, and sometimes years will pass. Oh, well, they've been working on their next record. What was the science behind something? A record gets into the top 10, and then who would decide, okay, we're going to release another one? Was there?
Well, they'd wait until until it started down. It climbed up the charts, mm-hmm. You know, and when it peaked and started back down, and they realized it was actually going to go down 10 points or so, well, then they'd start thinking about getting the next one ready.
Well, did disc jockeys play a role in that? Maybe they had the record and they started playing something else on it, and next thing you know, there was a buzz. Did that ever happen?
That happened with one record. Mm-hmm. In Australia, they didn't like the new single, whatever it was, so I don't remember, Yep, maybe, or mm-hmm. something like that. So they took out Peter Gunn from the album. That was an album cut, the second album. Especially for you. And they played that, and it got to the top five in Australia. So England saw that. They saw that in their charts, and they released it as a single. It got to number one there. And so finally, they decided they'd release it as a single in the United States. So that was the record companies that made those decisions. Uh-huh. And, of course, the DJs were of great help because they played the records, and if they didn't get a reaction on them, they didn't play them again.
Right.
So you could tell, you know, by the audience, the fans actually chose the hits in those days.
Uh-huh. Now, when you had your first top 10, you were living out in Arizona?
Yes, yeah.
I don't know if we ever asked you this question. It's one of my favorite questions to ask me people in this business, and that is, do you remember turning on the radio and actually hearing yourself and looking at your radio going, oh my gosh, that's me.
Yeah, that was a big thrill, first time that happened. And I think it first happened with Moving and Grooving, of course, and and hearing it. We were in the middle of cutting Rebel Rouser, I think, and Dick Clark was playing Moving and Grooving on the TV in the office, in Floyd Ramsey's office, and he came and got us and said, Moving and Grooving is playing, so we rushed in and looked at it and watched him dance to it. It was a big thrill.
Yeah.
A bunch of kids at that time.
A lot of people don't realize, with all the talk today about the technology in the studios, a lot of people don't realize the care that you put into getting a particular sound that would just jump out of the radio speakers at that time. You really took a lot of time with that, didn't you?
Yes, we did. It took us all day to record a song. And then Lee Hazelwood was my producer in those days. And he would take it to California then and mix it, overdub it, usually, because we didn't have a sax player in Phoenix. So we had to go to California, to Hollywood, to get one. And he'd take it to Gold Star Studios over there and overdub the sax. And then Rebel Rouser, he put the sharps on there to do the oohs and the ahs and the yells and everything. Mm. And then he'd mix it at Gold Star and add their echo to the water tank echo we already had.
Mm.
And then he'd master it, which was another process, the final process in the whole thing. And he'd always add a couple of, bump it up a couple of dBs so it'd be louder. But he mixed it particularly for Top 40 radio in those days, so that when they played it, it sounded, it came out of your radio, it just sounded great, you know.
I'm wondering, did you guys do the same thing? I heard a story years ago, and this had to do with Berry Gordy, but I wonder if you and Lee Hazelwood did the same kind of thing. The story was that in the recording studio, after all of the big speakers and everything with the, whatever they were doing, that he would then take it and put it down into the little tiny talkback monitor because he wanted to hear what it would sound like when it was coming out of a small radio speaker. And I often wondered if you did the same kind of thing, because, again, your guitar just jumped out of that speaker. Dwayne Eddy was on the radio. You knew Dwayne Eddy was on the radio.
Yes, we did. We did mix that way. Later on, I went to the mixes, and we'd always mix them on the big speakers, and then we'd switch them to those little ones and make sure that the balance was right and the guitar wasn't too loud or too soft. And you could tell on the little speakers it would cut through more, and you'd think it was maybe too low on the big speakers, and then you'd put it on those little ones, and there it was. It'd come romping out of those little speakers. We had a couple of little speakers set up just for that purpose.
We're talking with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member who has had more rock and roll instrumentals on the charts than anyone ever, Dwayne Eddy. More coming up at Newstalk 720 WGN. Newstalk 720 WGN with Steve King and Johnny Putman. I know every time we play this, we get emails from people saying, where can I get that? Well, you can't. Dwayne was nice enough several years ago to send us a copy of some songs that Dwayne and our friend Doyle Dykes were working on and decided they weren't good enough to release. Dwayne, you got to release those.
Well, I don't know. It's not that they aren't good enough. It's just that I just don't know. I didn't think anybody would want them.
Really. Oh, golly.
Well, speaking of that, we have to ask you, what's the latest with your new album? And I'm going to take you in another direction, too, because since that cute girl you hang out with was nice enough to post something on the Gretsch pages, I'm going to ask you about something she hinted at, that there's a possibility you may be finding a way to get back on the road and maybe doing a little touring?
Well, we were talking about it. Yeah, we were, when I was out in Hollywood doing the thing at the Hollywood Bowl, after they heard the big orchestra play with me, why Monroe, my producer, came up with this idea and mentioned it out loud to these guys, and said, you know, it'd be nice if Dwayne could do a tour of playing with orchestras in different cities, you know. And so they liked that idea, so we're running past a few agents, so maybe next year they'll book me in some different cities with the symphony orchestra and have them play with me.
Pinch me.
I have three words for you.
What?
Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
That's right.
I'd love to. I know they got a great one there.
Yeah.
What is the latest with the album that you're working on?
Well, we're about two-thirds, three-fourths done with it.
Great.
We only work on it when we get time. Mm-hmm. Monroe has to make a living in between.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. Paying for those groceries and the car payments and all that. So he takes on other jobs of producing other artists. But we still get in there and do a thing or two. We were in there the other day working on something. So we're gaining on it, but it's a slow process with not having the budget and the time to just straight out do it, you know.
So we'd be okay if we hadn't actually heard some of the cuts, but we're just so anxious because of what we heard just blew us away.
We're thinking about doing that, just putting like about seven of them that we finished.
Mm-hmm.
On a disc and sending them out to a few friends and see what kind of reaction
you
get.
You tease.
Like your close personal friend, Steve and Johnny?
In Chicago?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, you talk about having to do other things, you're having the time to do it, but I don't want to embarrass you. But realistically, I think one of the other reasons that this has taken you as much time as it is, you have always been a perfectionist.
Yeah, and the technology these days, they've got, it's come, it's like aviation. It's come from the Wright brothers to the 747, and it's the same in the recording business. Came from three-track, where I started, to unlimited number of tracks and Pro Tools, and you have an infinite amount of choices, and even setting up for a mix. These days, they only do a, we used to do a mix in 3 hours,
mm-hmm.
and maybe the first one would take four hours, but then we'd be set up and we'd run them off for about 3 hours for a mix for every song in the album. And nowadays, it takes, you can only do one song in a day,
mm-hmm.
so. Because they've got so much stuff to hook up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you, do you find that you have the same problem, if you will, that we've talked with Les Paul about, that this technology works for you and it works against you? On one hand, you've got all of these options. On the other hand, you want to kind of capture that adrenaline that you get in a performance. And if you get too bogged down with the options, it can get too perfect, and you lose that feeling. And you've always had that incredible feeling in yourself.
Exactly, and that's a battle I'm fighting with the engineers that work on this, you know, is to, and with Monroe, too, because he's younger. He's used to working with the perfection, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they can edit your note. You can... like I'll backphrase sometime on a passage or something, and the notes fall behind the beat a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And engineers say, "Oh, I can fix that." And I say, "Well, no,
mm-hmm.
don't fix it. I meant to do that."
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
I've quoted you many times. I remember one of our first interviews, and you said it's got to be a little dirty.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it, otherwise it just doesn't have the soul.
Yeah, I know it, and I can fix that mistake. No, I meant to do that. I want to leave it. That's not a mistake. This sounds like it. It's just funky. You know?
I love it. I know when you talk to us, you put up with us because I always drag you down memory lane, but I just love the story. So would you put up with me again?
Sure.
Okay. Talking with Duane Eddy I know you've told stories about when you started. You were just a teenager working in honky tonks and in bars, and I guess, you know, you wanted to play, and the gigs were there, and that was great. But didn't you actually start playing guitar when you were just a little guy of like 5 or 6 years old?
Well, I first saw one when I was 5 years old. It was standing in the corner, and I said to my father, "What is that?"
Well, whose was it?
It was his. He knew about three chords on it and played for his own amusement. And so he taught me the three or four chords he knew, and I just fell in love with it.
Did you see that you, as a five-year-old, you thought, wow, I'd like to be, was there somebody like on the big screen?
Gene Autry, Roy Rogers.
Oh, really?
You're singing my song.
Oh.
Yep.
Yeah.
But as a five-year-old, how the heck did you get your hands around the neck of the guitar?
Well, it was hard. It was hard making those chords. I didn't, and I was like 8 or 9 before I realized you could play up the neck, you know, that those... I just thought it was supposed to be, it was just that far, you know, for the chords, the C chord, E chord, and D, and so forth. I didn't realize you could, and then I saw a guy playing up the neck and playing notes and everything. Oh, I see. I can do that. Well, that opened a whole new world to me.
So you wanted to be a singing cowboy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even got a little picture somewhere here. Of me doing that. You know, I'd sing happy birthday to my neighborhood friends.
Yeah.
One of 8 or 9 and so forth. And I sang at school.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of times. And sang country songs, you know, accompanied myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working when I was 15 in Coolidge, Arizona.
Now, was there a problem with you just being 15 and being in places where, you know, you had to be of age?
No, nobody paid any attention.
If it was good music, they said, oh, let that Eddie kid get up there and play. No big deal.
Yeah, it was just the band came in, nobody paid any attention to us anyway, and they were more worried about the fights and and selling their booze, you know.
In fact, I have to ask you, we've never gone here, but I have to ask you this. Did you have the same kind of instructions, if you will, in the band that we did when I was playing in bars, and I was underage playing in bars here in Chicago? And everybody in the band knew, if there's an underage drinking raid, stay up on stage, and the cops won't pay any attention to you because you're with the band.
Right. Well, I never had that, but I never drank, so I didn't have to worry about it anyway.
Well, neither did Steve.
I didn't drink either, but it was just kind of...
They'd hog you away if you were just in the joint.
Oh, yeah. Well, they told me just... All right, you're not supposed to be in here, but if you stay on the stage, I guess you'll be all right. Or near the stage, so that's what I did. And for the 3 or 4 hours, I'd be there.
And
when it was over, I just packed up, and they were closed, and then I could walk back out, you know.
And that sounds like, to some people, maybe ancient history, but there's an 8-year-old blues guitarist, 8 years old, out of Wisconsin. And it's caused a bit of a stink up there because his dad drives him to these roadhouses and places where, you know, there's drinking going on, and he walks him in the back door, and the kid steps up on stage and he plays a tune, the crowd goes wild, and dad whisks him off the stage and takes him, you know. It's not like he hangs around and has a beer with him. And he's been reported, and the dad's in a heap of trouble, and, you can't let this boy work in bars.
True story, this is the little 8-year-old kid that a month or so ago when we were up in Milwaukee, we were emceeing Les Paul's concert up at the Pabst Theater, and this little 8-year-old guy was on stage with Les, but his father had a great quote, because in the state of Wisconsin, if a child is with their father, they can go into a bar and they could actually have a beer. So his father said, wait a minute, what's wrong with this picture? I can take my 8-year-old kid into a bar and I can hand him a beer and that's okay. But if I hand him a guitar, that's illegal.
Yeah, that doesn't make much sense, does it? That's great. I don't see anything wrong with that other than he's up awfully late. But, you know, if he's just coming in the back door and right on stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's good experience for one, playing for an audience like that.
But as Les Paul said, when the kid whipped out his sunglasses and put them on, no, you're not going to outdo me. And he reached down and got in the first row, and he saw that Les saw that the guy had sunglasses in his pocket, and he said, give me those. And he put them on and said, now you can play.
Now we're even.
That's right.
That's cute. Well, I'll leave it to Les. He's the character.
Yeah.
We're talking with Duane Eddy, the man who has more rock and roll instrumental hits than anyone ever. Thank you very much. He is a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, going into the Musicians Hall of Fame. More coming up with Duane Eddy at News Talk 720 WGN. News Talk 720 WGN with Steve King and Johnny Putman, and you're not hearing this because, of course, it would, you know, nobody's ever supposed to have live recordings from concerts. For example, if Duane Eddy were playing with B.B. King at the Hollywood Bowl, but you don't know that we're playing this, do you, Duane?
No, I can't hear it. You're talking over it.
That's right. does it freak
you
out?
I hear that.
Are you ever surprised at the stuff that pops up on YouTube?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do.
I mean, it shocks me. I mean, and the quality is good. I mean, you can tell that real fans want to share that concert-going experience, and so they'll, you know, they rush home from a concert and they post a video.
Off of their phones.
Off of their phones, yeah. That's incredible. And what amazes me, too, is some of the old stuff that gets unearthed.
I know.
We've had musicians in here before, and I've brought up YouTube, and they'll sit right here next to us and go, what? Well, where did that come from? That's from 1968.
I know.
They have no idea.
I know.
Well, we're talking.
I see that, too, every once in a while.
We're talking with Duane Eddy, the man who is going into the Musicians Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
More coming up. Stay with us at News Talk 720 WGN. News Talk 720 WGN with Steve King and Johnny Putman. Fortunate enough to spend some time with the man who has sold more instrumental records than any rock and roll performer. Duane Eddy, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, going into the Musicians Hall of Fame. And Duane, I was just playing this little fantasy concert in my mind as we're playing Because They're Young. I'm thinking Duane Eddy and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. This would work for me.
It'd work for me, too. That's a great symphony.
We're going to make that happen.
Yeah, let's do.
You know, we were talking about, we mentioned Les. We can't talk about playing guitar without mentioning our dear friend Les Paul. But now, there was, of course, the Les Paul guitar and the Chet Atkins guitar.
Chet Atkins Gretsch.
Right.
Yeah.
But, Duane, you're the first rock guy to have a signature guitar, right?
As far as I know, I think I was. Yeah.
It was
the Guild guitars.
Mm-hmm.
1960, early 60s?
1962, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that for several years. Then in the 90s, Gretsch, I got talking with Fred Gretsch, and he wanted to make a signature model for me. So we were with them for a few years. And then Gibson. And Gretsch went to Fender, so and they didn't say anything to me about it, so I said, well, I told Fred, I said, well, let's just, you do your thing, and I'll go ahead and do mine. And so I went to Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the new Gibson. It's amazing.
That's a gorgeous-looking guitar. And if people want to see the guitar we're talking about, you can go to Gibson Guitars. Just go to Gibson.com, and you can see the Duane Eddy signature guitar. And you can go to YouTube, and Duane, you've done some nice videos that Gibson has put up with you talking about the guitar and about your days on the road and some other things.
Yeah, you know, the first guitar I ever bought, I mean, the first electric guitar I ever bought was when I was 15, the hardware store there in Coolidge, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Was a Les Paul Gold Top.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a show in Nashville one time with Les Paul and Chet Atkins. And I was telling the story how I said, you know, I turned to Les and I said, you know, Les, the first guitar I ever had was a Les Paul Gold Top. He says, really? I didn't know that. And Chet leans over and says, yeah, but Duane, tell him what you traded it in for. Which, of course, was the Gretsch Chet Atkins.
Oh, yep. That's great.
And which Chet knew, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, that was funny. And then my last birthday here, last spring, Gibson gave me a copy of that very same first guitar, the 53-54 gold top.
Oh, that's neat.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Now, for non-guitarists, when we talk about a signature guitar, it's more than just having your signature on it. They actually make it to your specifications, right?
Right, right, yeah. And if you want to try something new or change something, you can do that.
And in fact, with your Gibson signature guitar, Mike McGuire. He worked pretty closely with you on getting the specs just the way you wanted them, right?
He did, and he's been wanting to make a guitar for me for, I don't know, 30, 40 years.
Wow.
I've known him for nearly 30 years now, and ever since I've known him, he's wanted to do that. And he's the head luthier at the custom shop there at Gibson, so...
Well, it is when Johnny and I heard it when we were down in Nashville at the Ryman Auditorium, it really is a guitar that cuts through everything. I mean, it's just and I've told you this before. A lot of people can try to do that the low note twang stuff. There's just something you do that is so unique. Nobody can. It's like the classic, often imitated, never duplicated.
Yeah, I know it's. The only thing bad about it is, you know how when people honor artists and things, you know, and they put them in these Hall of Fames, usually other people do their songs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go do my own.
Good for you. Yep.
That's right.
Nobody else can do it.
They're all good. They've got their hands up going, not me, no way. That's funny.
Yeah. We've just had an email from Peter, who's over in London, where the Duane Eddy Circle is very big over there. And he said, you have to ask Duane if he gets the symphony tour going, is there any chance that he would wind up in Great Britain?
Well, if I can figure out a way to either not fly or fly by private jet, yeah. I don't want to go to any airports if I can help it.
Yeah. Or you're singing our song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I'd love to do that. I'd love to go to London and do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Steve mentioned the Duane Eddy Circle. That's a very active fan club group of yours. And
they're a great bunch of guys.
They are.
They are. And... they have a convention every year. They've just had their 30th one, and 30th convention this last spring in May, I think it was. And it's quite amazing. There's several hundred of them get together, and they play all the songs and catch up on the news, and they'll play anything new I've done or any new shows they've got and that I've done and so forth. And they have the Twang Gang.
I love that.
Yeah. Philip Pell and the guys, and they all get up there and play the songs. They play songs I'd be afraid to try, even though I recorded them in albums or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But so many of them, I've kind of forgotten them over the years. And they'll say, well, I'm doing something or other, and it's very obscure. I think, well, you got a lot of guts to try that, you know.
I know we've talked about this before, but for people that don't know, Duane has a wonderful, really a treasure trove of suitcases and things from when you were touring back in the 50s. And I got to ask you again, you working on the book? Any chance that's going to happen?
Well, if there's any interest, I don't know. I figure... I'm kind of waiting for a happy ending. You know, but I hope I'm not too old before it comes along, you know. But, no, I've been working on it a little bit, but if there's some interest in it, I'd probably get busy and finish it up. But as right now, I don't know if there would be.
Just being, I guess Steve and I have talked about this so many times, especially as we're driving down to Florida, and we think of you and Deed as we approach Nashville, and we think, well, just kind of allowing us to be a fly on the bus, if you will. You know, that kind of approach to the, here are the people who are on the tour, and, you know, here are some of the ups and downs of being on the road.
Mm-hmm. I've written some of that, you know.
Good.
Yeah. I mean, because we, you know, in the bus, for example, one story I told is I had my gut string or an acoustic guitar along, and I'd get it out or somebody'd borrow it, and I remember Dion borrowed it one day, spotted it, and said, "Can I borrow that?" And I said, "Sure," and he takes it in the back of the bus. Mm. Pretty soon I hear, "You're cheating, Hart."
Mm.
And he's singing all these Hank Williams songs. And so I went back and I said, "How do you know all that?" You know, being from the Bronx, he said, "Oh, I listened to WCKY Cincinnati and... I can't remember now, I used to know, but the station at Wheeling, WWVA Wheeling, West Virginia, and listened to the Opry on Saturday nights, and I thought, well, that's the same thing I used to listen to.
Mm.
So he grew up being a country fan, too, and knew all those songs, but anyway, I'd get it out some nights, a guitar, and different people sing, and one night, Chubby Checker, who we thought could only do up-tempo things like the twist, he started singing. He said, "Give me an A," and I played A, and he started singing Unchained Melody.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah, and he sang it beautifully. And the Shirelles, of course, jumped in and were oohing and aahing behind him, harmonies and everything, and everybody else. And but Chubby just sang the stuffings out of it. And,
wow.
It was so beautiful that... when he finished up, you could have heard a pin drop, and we all just, that kind of, nobody wanted to do anything after that.
Huh.
Couldn't top that, so I put the guitar away, and we rolled on through the night, you know.
Dwayne, you've got to do the book. I just got goosebumps with that story. That you have to do the book.
Yeah, it was, you know, that's another thing. I wish they'd put Chubby in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's got the biggest record of the century.
Isn't that amazing?
Wasn't that cool?
But I have to, you have to love his reaction to it. Ever so humble, he said, well, of course the twist would be the biggest single of the past 50 years. I mean, it's like the telephone.
He's a little pumped up about it. He's a sweet guy.
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
I've known him since... back in those days, and he was always a sweetheart.
And how funny you mentioned Dion and how he was he loved and was raised on and country music, and his last two albums have been pure roots music.
Great blues.
Blues, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Hardcore.
Yeah. Well, it's just a short step from one to the other. They're both ethnic musics, I think, and, you know, it's just black and white and blues and country, you know. Just, there's not much difference. I remember Chuck Berry, I asked him one time, I said, "Who do you listen to, Chuck?" And he said, "Kitty Wells and the Everly Brothers."
Oh, my gosh.
Hmm.
I thought, well, now that's bizarre. You know, I would have, but he loved country music,
Kitty
too.
Kitty Wells, wow. Well, now, speaking of black and white, and I don't know that you've ever talked about this, but if we look back at the time when you were on a bus and you were traveling with these performers, did you ever come into a town where it wasn't okay for them to... for a Chuck Berry or a Chubby Checker to go in the front door or eat at the same place as you guys ate?
We did, I'm sorry to say. It was very, very upsetting times.
Sure, because these were your buddies, and yet you pull into a town and it was understood.
A few times I got off and ran in to get hamburgers for everybody on the bus, you know, and want to be traveling, and because... half of us couldn't go in. I got some other stories about that. And it was one time when a deputy... I won't even go into that.
Yeah.
It's just too ugly. But I nearly came out of my seat. And Charlie Carpenter, his arm shot across the aisle there, and he grabbed on the thing, and I knew I better sit back down, and I did. And when the sheriff got off the bus, he said, "It's their town. You don't mess with them."
Wow. But you see, that's really a microcosm of where we were then.
Yeah.
You know, from your vantage point, just coming into town, and okay, it's their town.
The black kids did not stay in our hotels in some of those towns.
Wow.
They had their hotels, and we had ours.
And yet they had number one records.
Yeah.
And the records were being purchased by the white kids who were coming out to see them.
Right.
That's amazing.
And I think that helped a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Just like Pat Boone helped Little Richard, you know?
Yeah.
Because he kind of watered it down, and then after they heard Pat's version, while they were ready for Little Richard to come romping through with his version of Tutti Frutti.
Yeah. You know?
And those kids would go to these shows, and they'd see a black act, a white act, a black act, a mm-hmm. white act, and two black acts, two white acts. And, you know, they'd see Sam Cooke, they'd see me, they'd see Annette, they'd see Frankie Avalon, and they'd see Laverne Baker and Chuck Berry.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no color, you know, between us. And but those kids would sit there and see this. And I think it's, you know, around the country, night after night, 20,000 people at a crack, all these kids, they love the music, mm-hmm. you know. I think it may have helped a little bit toward easing some of those taboos and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Frankly, I think you're understating it. I think it helped a lot in aiding integration. I'm curious. You also, when you first toured over in, let's go back to Great Britain again, was there that kind of separation of black and white performers in Great Britain or not?
No. No, there wasn't. No, they didn't. No, it didn't. It wasn't the same in Europe. No, no.
That's interesting. So much more relaxed.
Yeah, yeah. I ran into several black artists over there that had moved there and worked like in France or Germany or England, because you know, they could hang with everybody and nobody looked at them funny. Or they might look at them funny, but just as a novelty, they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
There was no prejudice or no overt prejudice or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they enjoyed their lives much better there. So,
I always love the stories, and I thank you so much for just, as I say, allowing me to drag you down memory lane.
Oh, what's an old man without his story?
You know, we've been threatening to do this, but one of these times, Johnny and I are just going to take a vacation, come down and bring a tape recorder,
yep.
and talk to you,
yep.
and that will be the book.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just talk to you, and then we'll leave you the tape and say, okay, here's the book.
Yeah, just write it up.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Everybody transcribe it. And,
yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Because the stories are so great. And
well,
just catching up with you is always a thrill for us.
And we want to remind everybody again that they can get tickets if they want to be a part of this when Duane is inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame. It's going to be October 28th, 7:30 at the Shermer Family Symphony Center. Shermerhorn? Okay, Symphony
yeah.
Center.
Dwayne, he just does this for a living. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well.
And we've got a link from our blog After Dark to your MySpace page, and also to the Tennessean article with information on the tickets and this terrific picture. Before we let you go, I have to ask you about this great picture that was taken of you in the Ryman Auditorium. That is so cool.
That was when I did that show that night. I think Peter Cooper interviewed me for that, and somebody took the picture.
Was that Chet Atkins Appreciation Days at the Ryman?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
April 2000.
It really captures the feel of the mother church, you know. And
it's beautiful, those windows.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
All that. Beautiful old place and a great place to work. I love it. And the Shermerhorn promises to be great, too. As the Hollywood Bowl was, because mm-hmm. that's they're all great. They've got great vibes and great acoustics, and it's great fun to work with.
And great history, too.
Well, and the Chicago yeah. Opera House is pretty cool, too, Dwayne.
That's right.
Right.
We're
going to
work on that.
We're going to get you up here.
Yeah, absolutely.
One way or another.
And since you've expressed interest, you know, we would we'd kick ourselves if we didn't do our part to put a bug in the right people's ear and say, hey, seize this opportunity.
If you find someone that's not afraid to take a chance, fine.
We know.
I think the reason I don't work is most promoters don't believe I could draw a crowd, and so they don't want to pay any money.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it just costs money to travel up
sure.
there with the band and pay everybody. And
okay, it's our job then to educate them, and then if necessary, drive down, get you, and bring you up here.
Well, the thing is, I'm afraid, you know, I'd hate to find out they were right.
Oh, no, stop it. No.
But I think we could do 2,000 or 3,000 people easily.
I think without a doubt. And on that happy note, because I have no doubt that that would happen, thank you for being so generous with your time, Dwayne.
You're welcome.
And
it's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. You're great.
And give that cute girl you hang out with a hug from us.
I will, and I'm sure she'd want me to say hello to you, too. So.
Well, I think I freaked her out a little bit. I said, we're going to be in Florida the week that you're going to be doing the concert down in Nashville, the 28th. And I just, you know, said to her, you know, we have every intention of hopping in the car on that Tuesday and driving up to the concert. And she said, oh, no. I said, no, really? We do.
Yeah.
You know, we're just going to head out that morning, get up there, do the show, and turn around and drive back down to Florida.
Either that or think about us and talk about us as you drive through Nashville.
Well, that's the norm. That's the norm, Dwayne.
I'm not going to let you forget that one.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, by the way, did you know Les Paul's out there doing a tribute to him November 15th at over in Cleveland?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. In fact, we had Les on talking about that
a
couple weeks ago.
He's so sweet. He said, well, if you kids will come to the show, I guess I'll show up.
So. He's great, isn't he?
He really is. He's a piece of work. Dwayne, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's great talking to you.
You too. Sleep good.
Hello to everybody out there listening.
Take care, Dwayne.
Take care.